Support comes from the Wiregrass Archives at Troy University's Dothan campus, identifying and preserving historical documents and photographs for research related to the Wiregrass region. More information at troy.edu/wiregrassarchives.
From Troy Public Radio, this is In Focus, and I'm Carolyn Hutchison. Energy costs continue to impact the U.S. economy. So we decided to check in with Caitlin Hammonds, Vice President and Gulf Coast Director of the Consumer Energy Alliance, to get her perspective. She joins us by Skype. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Caitlin, what does the nonprofit Consumer Energy Alliance do?
So Consumer Energy Alliance advocates for sensible energy policy that helps consumer costs stay affordable and helps us have reliable energy. But unfortunately, as energy has become more and more politicized, it's created this big policy divide in our country on how to move forward in the energy space.
Is there any particular reason you wanted to get into this arena?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Southeast Texas, which is kind of the Beaumont-Port Arthur area, and it is heavy, heavy in the energy and petrochemical industry. Southeast Texas is home to some of the largest crude oil refineries and petrochemical plants. And I grew up playing softball in front of some of those facilities. And my community was really brought up by the energy industry. Friends and family work in the industry. And so it's shown me growing up and to date now how important the energy industry is to our communities, but also to our country.
I noticed on your website that you use the term energy justice. What is energy justice?
Energy justice is really looking at how energy policies affect communities, specifically communities who are living at or below the poverty line, who really cannot spend a dollar more on gasoline or $20 more on electricity. Those communities are uniquely impacted and frankly pay a disproportionate amount for energy than other communities. And so energy justice is really looking at policies that are going to help lift those communities up, keep energy affordable and reliable, to make sure that, like, when gasoline prices go up, as they did last summer, folks aren't having to make the choice between getting gasoline to get to work or groceries or critical medicine or anything else that's going to be essential to their livelihood.
I recently learned from a previous interview that leases have been sold for more Gulf oil drilling. So a lot of your listeners are remembering the Deepwater Horizon disaster of April 20th, 2010. Are there any safeguards that have been put in place to guard against such a disaster in the future?
Absolutely. Since Deepwater Horizon, both the government and industry have really stepped up to make sure that nothing like this would ever happen again. So in coordination and then independently, government tightened regulations, the industry went to work and really went to improve technologies. Things like the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement were formed to help regulate the industry. New technologies have been developed. There have been safety training centers, and now we're in an environment, as far as offshore oil and gas industry goes, it's one of the most regulated environments in the U.S. and is the most regulated that it has ever been, to ensure that there are safeguards in place so that nothing like that happens again.
Do you know if by chance the Keystone Pipeline leak in that Kansas-Nebraska area, has that been repaired and will it ever be used again?
I know that they have been working on getting that completely repaired, and I'm not sure where the status of that project stands at this moment.
Caitlin, let's switch gears. You mentioned a minute ago power, electricity, and I'm aware that we have an aging power grid, and we have had some attacks on the power grid in North Carolina in late 2022 and early 2023. Is there anything that can be done to protect the grid from attack?
Absolutely. Congress and the federal government and federal agencies are looking at hardening the grid to help protect it against cybersecurity attacks in the future. Obviously, there are a lot of inputs that go into the grid, and so they are really looking at the best ways to protect our electric grid from any kind of attack. We've seen critical infrastructure, whether it be the grid or pipelines, or even, frankly, water supplies that have been subject to cybersecurity attacks. And those attacks are just amping up. There are foreign state actors and other bad actors in the world who are going to continue to step up their cybersecurity attacks against our critical infrastructure. So industry, along with government, again, are really working together to figure out the best way to harden the grid and secure them from any massive attacks again.
Well, speaking of the U.S. power grid, and it is aging, is it going to be able to accommodate more and more electric vehicles?
Obviously, along with more electric vehicles comes more capacity that our grid needs to see. Whether that capacity is produced by natural gas or wind and solar electricity, it could be all of the above. That being said, we are still going to have to add capacity to the grid to be able to fuel those electric cars, EVs and otherwise. So it's going to take a lot more input, which means that we need to continue to produce oil and natural gas, specifically natural gas, and be able to move that natural gas to the grid in a safe way, but also in a way that makes sense for those who are purchasing these EVs, especially with the proposed rule that came out of the Environmental Protection Agency that is asking for, I believe, over 60% of car makers' fleets to be electric vehicles. That's going to require a ton of capacity to be added to our grid. So the more that we can produce energy like natural gas here in the U.S. is simply just going to help us fuel that grid so that we can power those EVs.
And going back to what you first said about energy justice, meaning affordability and environmental stewardship, how affordable will this move be for their pocketbook?
That is a really tough thing to say. Electric vehicles have been relatively pricey. You also have to think about the fact that our electric vehicle network, if you're driving along the highway, you have to find somewhere to stop and plug in your car. Our electric vehicle network is also not built up to be able to sustain an increased amount of EV traffic on the roads, especially in neighborhoods that we would consider at or below the poverty line. And so when those folks are already paying a disproportionate amount on energy, we can't now ask them to go and find an electric vehicle to purchase and find a way to plug it in. Those living at or below the poverty line are typically those who actually drive further to work. So that will just increase the burden on them significantly.
If your listeners want to explore these issues further, do you have a website?
So you can go to consumerenergyalliance.org, and we have a ton of different resources, background and informational resources about policies, but also about how things work. So how oil and gas leasing and production in the Gulf of Mexico works, or how electric vehicles and the need to fuel the grid also work.
Well, Caitlin, I want to thank you for your time today. I hope we can talk again as these things develop in the future. Can we do that?
That'd be great.
Joining us by Skype was Caitlin Hammons, Vice President and Gulf Coast Director of the Consumer Energy Alliance. More information about energy issues can be found at the website, consumerenergyalliance.org. Thanks for joining us today for In Focus, which is now a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Carolyn Hutchison, and this is listener-supported Troy Public Radio.
Support for Troy Public Radio comes from Sunshine Behavioral Medicine, providing specialized psychiatric treatments of bipolar disorders and PTSD. More information at sunshine2000.com.